Welcome, everyone. We're on the home stretch here on Saturday. So this is session 355 with Bill Reel, which is Finding Human Connection in Post-Mormonism. Before we begin, you've probably heard this many times, but before we begin, please silence your cell phones to make sure to be respectful to our presenter as well as those who are attending. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when we engage in the Q&A portion at the end. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be from yours. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation down the hallway to my left. Don't forget also to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. This is a 90-minute session, so we'll end at 3:30, and we ask you, as you ask questions, to keep within that framework. So now about the presentation. Humans have always sought out human connection. Belonging inside one's tribe has always been a priority. This session will discuss the role of that evolution and how it's played in human survival and helped deconstructed Mormonism's sense of what it means to lean into human connection in a new way, where authenticity and vulnerability matter to a greater degree. Bill Reel, he is the founder and producer of the Mormon Discussion podcast. He's also the author of the Mormon Primer. Bill seeks to help Latter-day Saints deconstruct Mormonism in healthier ways, along with helping people wake up into human development. Again, after his remarks, I will have Q&A, so if you want to queue up at the end for this mic, he can answer your questions. So please join me in welcoming Bill.
So let me start by, if you guys in the front there could just do me a huge favor, if she falls asleep, if you'll just tap her on the shoulder. She's not a big fan of what I have to say sometimes, and so she tends to kind of fall asleep sometimes during things that I do. So hopefully the rest of you, I can keep you awake. I want to start by just saying, when you deconstruct Mormonism, like Mormonism isn't Methodism. It isn't the Baptist church. It isn't a system where you just show up on Sunday, you go for an hour, and you go home. Instead, what Mormonism is something that soaks into your bones. And for me, when I was a Latter-day Saint from the LDS tradition, Mormonism was my everything. Mormonism was my identity. Mormonism was how I made sense of the world. And as I became disconnected from the church, both starting off in Ohio, where these people are my friends, they're my family. Like, I love them and I can't wait to see them on Sunday. And little by little, I noticed that as my perspective is shifting and theirs is staying the same, I'm noticing that there's a tension that picks up when I'm at church on Sunday. People start to be a little more reserved with things I have to say. And then I get a job in southern Utah, and our family picks up, and we move. And I'm going to church in a ward where nobody knows me. And in that process, all of a sudden, it's like, you're a stranger, and you believe differently than us. And that distance grew even larger. And it hurt, because I like having connection with people. I like caring about people, and I like people caring about me. And eventually, as our family stepped away from activity, we had to find a new way to rebuild our world so that we could have friends and connection in various ways, which I'll talk about. So I want to start my conversation, and I want it to be a conversation. I hope if you have questions, and when we get to the end, there's no way I'm going to talk for an hour and a half. When we get to the end, if you have a question on what I said here, great. If you have a question on anything else, great. And here's what I want to say about the Q&A. I value deeply authenticity. I value deeply vulnerability. And I think in order to build a connected community and to be more connected to the world around you, you have to lean into that. And so I offer just simply saying that you can ask anything at the end. As I go through various kind of ideas. So I want to start off. How many here have read the book Sapiens by Yuval Harari? Okay. Sounds like maybe a handful, maybe a few more than a handful. Sapiens is a book written by non-Mormon, Yuval Harari. And his book essentially starts at the beginning of humanity and talks about how humans develop and why we develop the mechanisms that we do. And I think when people start to engage these ideas, they seem very foreign. So I hope I explain it right. If we go back in time, whatever it is, 2 million years ago, whatever that time frame is, doesn't matter. But at the very beginning, when humans enter this world, and again, I'm just going to say through evolution, when humans enter this world, we started off in very small groups of people, maybe a group of 5 or 10 or 15. And that group of 5 or 10 or 15, we trusted each other because we were intimately aware of each other. Like we gathered around the same fire at night, and we all danced together. And we told whatever those early stories were, but we were connected because we knew each other so well. As humans begin to develop, and I should probably say this too, if you go to the great ape family, which we are a member of the great ape family, and humans are actually closer in DNA to gorillas and chimpanzees, and I believe orangutans too, but chimpanzees and gorillas for sure, than some dog species are to other dog species. And that's an interesting note. Like, we're that close to members of the great ape family. The great ape family, the way in which monkeys stay connected with each other is through the process of grooming. And so tribes of monkeys will be in groups of maybe 15 up to as much as about 200. But every day, what monkeys do is they'll split off into groups, and they'll go and find their own little secluded place, and they'll just pick bugs off each other and take the knots out of each other's hair. And they'll spend that time grooming. The trouble with grooming is you can't do a whole lot else while you're picking gnats out of someone's head, right? And also, it takes some time to do that. And so somewhere along the way in evolution, humans develop something different about their vocal cords where they're able to make an extra 15 or 20 sounds. And suddenly the vocabulary of a human versus another member of the great ape family is exponentially larger. And obviously the whole point of evolution is survival of the species. It is that we perpetuate and we adapt. And so there's always going to be an advantage to a larger group that is cohesively interconnected versus a smaller group, because when those groups go to battle, and that is also, by the way, warring with each other, is a facet we find among the great ape family besides humans too. Jane Goodall, who was the lady famous for studying great apes, it was the chimps of Gombe. And the chimps of Gombe, this was an area where she was studying these chimps, and these chimps that were in tribal families would go to war against other tribal families of chimps and annihilate them, parole their borders, grab another member of another tribe, even if that member was originally, at some time back, a member of their own tribe, and then just beat them to death and tear them to shreds. So war, battling us versus them, has been something since the beginning of time. And as humans are trying to survive, and as evolution and as just strength of numbers always benefits the larger group, there was a need to develop mechanisms in order to bind us together in larger groups. What Sapiens talked about was the idea that once you get beyond about 15 to 25 people, you no longer know the members of your group well enough to be able to be intimately connected with each other. It doesn't work. So suddenly there was a human invention. I find this fascinating. There was a human invention called gossip. And I don't mean invention like I'm going to go into the lab every day and try to invent gossip and make it work. No. But it was invented unintentionally. So humans, because of the ability to have language to the degree that they did, and the rest of the great ape family not having that, humans developed the ability to start telling stories. And the first thing we did was start to tell stories about each other. We look at gossip as a negative thing. Gossip can deeply diminish and marginalize others as we speak about them behind their back. But it also tells stories about who can be trusted and who can't, who's the strongest to take on the hunt and who we should be careful of because they're clumsy and they're going to get us killed. It tells stories about who gathers the fastest and who's the sloppiest and brings back the rotten berries off the bush. So gossip became a deeply important human tool in building a level of trust that's one layer away. I know my wife, Amanda, but I don't know this gentleman. But if my wife knows this gentleman, she can now gossip to me his level of trust that I should place in him. And so we humans use stories to now be able, instead of 15 to 25 who are connected on intimate awareness of each other, we now could go up to about 150 with gossiping. So you can keep a group, they've done studies on this, you can keep a group of 150 and smaller cohesively connected by talking about each other. And gossip doesn't have to be negative. Gossip can be like, hey, did you hear about Frank? Frank killed the mammoth all by himself, right? So it tells positive and negative stories, but it conveys to the tribe what our roles are and what we're good at and what we're not and where we should be trusted and where we shouldn't. And so it is this cohesive factor. At about 150, gossip doesn't work anymore because now I know her and she knows him, but he doesn't know the guy in the back, and neither does she, and neither do I. And so gossip becomes ineffective. It's at this point in human history, because stronger groups always survive if they can be cohesive. It's at this point in human history when myth comes in. The ability to tell stories about us and about them. And when you think about how important myth is, like if you go to battle and it's America versus ISIS or Islamic terrorist, I can stand next to somebody I absolutely don't know, but because they wear the same uniform, because we have a collective story about who we are and who they are, we now can essentially get a group of unlimited numbers to cohesively work together for the survival and adaptation of the tribe. It's at that point that myth comes in, and there are certain kinds of myth stories that best support larger groups, and there are certain kinds of myth stories that best support smaller groups. And I will simply say that when it comes to religion, those types of myth stories do really good. I was talking to Anthony Miller last night, if any of you know him. Anthony's a very wise person, very wise voice. And Anthony made the comment that Latter-day Saints or Mormons do first half of life or stage three, black and white kind of thinking, ethnocentricity, tribal mentality, do that half of life better than anybody. But at some point, if you deconstruct your religious system, you've lost your tribe, and now you have to figure out ways to replace it. In the smaller group, we are evolutionary designed to work together. If you take a human being by himself, place him in the middle of the rainforest, and say, go 3 years and survive, sooner or later he's going to get eaten by something. If you take 10 humans and you put them in the middle of the rainforest and you say, work together and survive, almost assuredly, if you come back 2 years later, they're still there. Human, whereas some animals do really well on their own, we are evolutionary designed to be together and to work together and to have some sort of tribe or community. And so you can sense how we, through evolution, move from this small, intimate, cohesive group to using gossip, to using myth. And all of a sudden, we all bought into a myth. And it doesn't have to be a religious myth. Maybe we bought into the myth of America. Like, on this side of the line, I'm American, and on this side of the line, I'm a Mexican, right? There's this idea that we have these arbitrary lines, these arbitrary boundaries, which are always dividing us and them. And as we start to deconstruct those myths and those arbitrary constructs, we suddenly are left with going like, oh, color doesn't matter. Sexual orientation doesn't matter. Where you were born doesn't matter. We are human. And but now as you've deconstructed all that, your tribe says like, ooh, sorry, you can't be here anymore. And so now you need a new community. And so today I wanted to offer some thoughts on what that could look like and offer some stories about some of these tools and resources that I've found useful in my life. The first thing, and I think most of you gather this as you've deconstructed systems, is the further you get into that process, the more you tend to take a step back. And you begin to see kind of the world with a different lens. You're no longer in what's called ethnocentricity, where like, hey, my tribe's the best tribe. My tribe has all the answers. These are the right people, and anybody else is either bad, uninformed, or somehow set out to distract me from perpetuating my tribe. And as you step back and you have this lens of like, oh, we're just a human race. And even further back, where you start to see like the importance of other creatures in this world and how the planet is interconnected. And you begin to sense like, oh, I've got to come up with new stories. I've got to come up with new views and new perspectives in order to come to grips with my own changing world that I perceive and my own changing kind of internal perspective inside. So one thing is this, continued learning. I would bet if I asked for a show of hands of people in here who listen to various podcasts, read books, are always trying to figure out new things, I bet almost all of you would raise your hand, if not all of you. One of the things that is true for people who are, and I'm going to call it awakened, and I don't mean that as a derogatory statement towards those who aren't at this stage yet, but for those who are awakened, you value information. You value learning. You value diversity. You value multiple perspectives. And the way you got there was by reading and thinking and learning and asking questions. One of the ways you got there was by challenging your own beliefs, challenging your own ground that you hold, and trying to figure out like, oh, this is what I always thought. Here's some new information. I'm going to open myself up to changing my mind on these things. And there are differences between people who maintain the perspectives they've had since they were younger and people who are willing to change their beliefs and adapt. And adaptation, again, is an evolutionary mechanism that we have. One of the things I talked about just now is inclusiveness for diversity. I grew up in a white, European, essentially, American home where I perceived the world worked a certain way. There were a lot of heavy drinkers in my family. There were a lot of people who used racial slurs. There was a lot of homophobia in the home that I grew up with and in my extended family of cousins and aunts and uncles. One of the things I've had to do is confront my own racism, my own homophobia. I was at a Sunstone conference a few years ago, and I was sitting and talking to Kimberly Anderson, a transgender female. And as I'm talking to Kimberly, Kimberly said, Bill, I'm so appreciative of what you do. You make such a safe space for folks like me. And I said, Kim, hold on. Slow down. You don't know the whole story. The whole story is that I'm still homophobic. There's still things deep inside me at times that are racist or homophobic. And I am trying my darndest, Kim, to protect you from people like me. I think it takes a level of vulnerability to admit in each of us, like, oh, my growing up taught me certain things. My parents taught me certain things. My cousins, my aunts, my uncles. And to some degree, as much as we like to say, like, no, no, I'm progressive. I'm not that way anymore. Those things are still deep inside us. One part of vulnerability is starting to acknowledge that you still hold some of those things and hitting them head on. I was recently at a wedding of my two friends, Mikkel and Kelsey, a lesbian couple. They're incredible. Two other friends of ours, Miles and Jim, two gay men, they're at the reception. And there was a part in this reception where afterwards I'm just sitting talking to them, and I say something, and it's homophobic, I say something and they're immediately come to me and they go like, whoa. Rather than go like, oh, I meant it this way, or oh, I meant it that way, I just stood with them and said like, oh, yeah, wow, I can't believe I did that, and apologize and made it right. My point being is that all of us still harbor these things. If we're going to develop and grow, we've got to be vulnerable to our own weaknesses. We've got to be vulnerable to our own flaws, and we've got to continue to acknowledge them. As you develop, you become much more inclusive of diversity. You become much more aware of people who have differences, and you become much more accepting of like, oh, they've got that shadow, but why am I going to give them a hard time because I've got my own shadow. I've got my own things that are going on. And so you start to realize like even the problems other people have, they're not my problems, but they're my problems. They just go under a different name. And you begin to be very accepting of just human beings and the struggle that it is to be a human. Another thought is meditation and Eastern thought. So here we are in the West, and we even take the Christian religion or Jesus, and we very much Westernize him. And my suggestion would be is that those from Eastern thought have been doing this sitting with yourself a whole lot longer than the people on this continent have. And some of their spiritual systems are much more mature, and there seems to be some voices of wisdom deeper in them. So as you become more aware of new things and information and learning, one suggestion would be is to open yourself up to at least some ideas within Eastern thought. Ideas like being present and not worrying about the past and not worrying about the future, but sitting in this very moment, like here we are in a room, and I'm looking around at your faces, and I don't care what happened yesterday, and I don't care where I'm going in 2 hours. I'm enjoying the moment of just being with you and talking, being present with people. I was out in the hall just before this session, and I was talking to a listener of the podcast. And as we're talking, there's for just a second, I go like, okay, how much time do I have? This conversation has to end in a few minutes so I can make sure I get into this session. And then all of a sudden, I caught myself like, there's plenty of time. Relax. Just be with this person for a moment and just listen to them. Hear their story. When you're sitting with people, be present. Listen to their story. Give people a chance to talk. Don't dismiss them. Don't be in your head trying to get away. But be present. Some conversations are going to be interesting. Some conversations will be less than interesting. But make your best effort to be present in the moment with other humans that are standing in front of you. Meditation. I don't meditate that much. I honestly almost feel like I don't have enough time to meditate. Maybe you feel that way too. I'll tell you a secret. As I've talked to people that I perceive as being awakened and developed, about 90% of them point to having a meditation practice in their life. So I'm simply saying that while I'm not doing it, it seems to be an incredible tool into growth and development and becoming a more well-rounded human being. I think the secret of meditation is that it alters your perception of your own consciousness and of the world around you, and you begin to see that things work in different ways. So meditation and Eastern thought. I want to talk a moment about psychedelic drugs. We in our country, back in the 1940s and 50s, the government and other agencies worked very hard to make certain drugs illegal. And now, here we are in 2019, and we're beginning to reevaluate that. You already see medical cannabis, and in some states, recreational cannabis, become legalized. That's going to sweep the nation at some point. It's already in that process. I think we just saw Colorado recently legalize psychedelic mushrooms. And there are other tests going on with drugs like LSD and MDMA, which is known as ecstasy. I want to share some feedback on those. So in terms of psychedelic mushrooms, in our heads, we've been told a narrative about how these psychedelic substances are simply like an escape from the world in a way that it's like, oh, that's recreational and it isn't useful. There are tons of studies out, and again, you can just pull out your phone and you could just Google psychedelic mushrooms, recent studies, and you're going to find the studies have come out that said that people who use psychedelic mushrooms are more inclusive, they're more open, they are more, there was another word I wanted to use. Oh, accepting. They're more accepting, they're more open, they're more inclusive. And so as they've done studies, they said it does change the brain, but it doesn't change the brain in this negative way that we've always been told. It changes your brain in a positive way. It makes connections that allow you to start to perceive more of the collective us rather than us versus them. And so as you start to see it over the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to notice that states are beginning to entertain the idea that these kinds of substances should be legalized for various positive reasons. Another one is MDMA. We know it's ecstasy. We have the story in our head that people go to the rave, they take ecstasy. By the end of the night, they've had sex with 4 or 5 people, and it's crazy insane. The studies that I've read are much different than that. Those who take MDMA, they've done a study with military personnel who experience PTSD. If anybody in the room knows much about PTSD, it is something you, up until now, you can't get rid of. You can diminish it. You can reduce it. You can give people tools and resources to deal with it, but you can't get rid of it until now. What they've done is they took people who had PTSD and they gave them 3 separate sessions where they gave them the drug MDMA, had them under that influence of that drug, sit with a professional therapist and have 3 sessions, just 3, where they would sit and talk through their trauma. When that study was done, they found that 76% of patients 1 year later, I think it was the time frame, their PTSD was gone. Gone. So there are drugs that do helpful things. People who take medical cannabis, we've already heard all the arguments there in terms of seizures or pain. And then another option, too, just to mention, in terms of recreational cannabis tends to make you more present. You tend to just sit in the space you're in and be more present with people and not be so focused on the past or the future. It is a conscious altering drug. Another drug I'm aware of, ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is this like putrid, like syrupy, nasty. You drink it, and for the next 5 hours, you are throwing up in a bucket and you are on a vision quest. And for those people who take ayahuasca, if you go read the articles and the studies done on that, it is life-changing. They have this one-night experience, and they walk away positively changed forever. We have to, as awakened people, start to reevaluate what the usefulness is of substances that change or alter our consciousness. Just like meditation, changing our consciousness seems to be a huge tool in moving us out of ethnocentricity, being worried about our tribe, and moving us to a space where we start to see like, oh, I got to take care of this planet. Oh, I've got to take care of people and care for people and reduce trauma to people who are different than me. Oh, my way may not be the only way to do things. And so it causes in us a lot more openness. Again, acceptance, inclusiveness, and a lot more awareness and care and concern for others around us. I want to talk a moment about friendships. So on my podcast, I brag all the time about having the best friends in the world. And I thought today, like the main thing I wanted to convey to you today was to have a conversation with you about how you could leave here and try to build your own community. And it's not easy. There's not a simple like, hey, if you just like write up some invitations and drop them off to your neighbors, next thing you know, you'll have a group of 15 who are intimately connected with each other. It isn't simple. And there isn't a trick to it. And another thing that makes it difficult is that we are all different. We're all a little quirky in various ways, especially for those of us who deconstruct systems. Like our quirkiness already placed us at a little bit of a distance from our tribe. And so that quirkiness, that being different, that not being able to fully assimilate with these other folks over here, already puts us, if I'm honest, at a slight disadvantage of connecting with each other. Because I'm looking at one person and saying, man, they're a little weird. And the other person's looking at me and going, that Bill guy's a little weird. We're going to have to move past that. We're going to have to start valuing quirkiness and differences and diversity. So one thing I would suggest, here's what we've done. In Southern Utah, where I live, we are always wanting to meet new people. And the trouble is you think like you take Mormonism apart and you're like, oh, those guys demand that I fit in this box and I do things that way and I'm done with that. Now I get to be myself. And the reality is bullcrap. The reality is every group has boundaries and lines and rules. You don't just get to be yourself and say, like, the world, these people have to accept me. It doesn't work that way. It would be beautiful if it did. It doesn't work that way. The goal, though, is to move into communities that are more accepting, more inclusive, more willing to, like, sit with you as your own self, your own different human being, and say, like, I'm going to sit with that. I welcome you in. And again, it's not easy, but one of the things we do is we look for people. We invite people to things. We spend time with people. We go to dinners with people. If you sit in your house and you say, like, hey, it'd be really cool if I had friends. I wish that somebody would invite me to something. It doesn't work. You have to invite others to things. You have to make it a point that I'm going to love people, and I'm going to invest in people, and I'm going to make an effort to, like, bring these people together and let them be as much of themselves as they're willing to be. But you have to do that too. You have to be yourself. You have to be willing to tell your most embarrassing stories. You have to be willing to tell people your shadows. You have to be willing to put yourself out there and to risk it. Brené Brown has a quote that says something like, if you're not in the ring getting your ass kicked, then I don't care about your opinion. And that's true here too. You have to risk it. And sometimes you're going to get your ass kicked. That's going to happen. So one thing is you have to start it. If you want a community, start it. Start inviting people. And don't say like, oh, I'm sorry, you're 10 years too old, you can't be here. I'm sorry, you're 10 years too young, you can't be here. And what you're going to find over time as you invite people to participate with you in a sacred space with you, a safe space with you, is that you're going to discover that if you let people be themselves, all we humans want to do is be accepted for who we are. In that prior system, we tried so hard to fit in. Fitting in means I'm going to change myself so that I appear to be what you need me to be so I can be here. And at some point, every one of you, I'm guessing, got tired of fitting in. It cost too much. You lost too much of yourself in doing that. And so at some point you said, like, I don't want to fit in anymore. I want to belong. And belonging means I get to be as much of me as I feel safe in doing, and other people will accept that. So my suggestion again, start building a community. Reach out. Invite people. Don't put as few, and again, every tribe has rules, put as few arbitrary constructs around what that group has to look like as possible. Make space for people to be different. Celebrate difference. Don't make fun of someone's differences, but invite them into your space, this sacred space of saying, like, hey, tell me how you're different. I was at a get-together about 6 months ago, and I'm with a friend that I've known for about 6 months, and I've worked really hard in our community to be a safe space for people to be different and to feel accepted and to feel loved. This person sitting next to me looked at me and goes, Bill, I want to be more of myself with you. I want to tell you what I consider to be like my darkest secret, but I'm scared you're not going to be able to hold it. I looked over and I said, I'm going to hold this. You say whatever you feel safe in saying, but I'm here. he ends up saying something to me. He tells me, like, this is it. This is my thing. I said, all right, that's not my thing, but I have a different thing. I've got my own shadows. I've got my own flaws. I've got my own things I'm scared of. I've got my own things I don't want to tell anybody because I'm embarrassed by. The safer the space you can set up so that people can talk about the things they want to talk about, but we're also dang scared that we're going to be shamed or marginalized or diminished for saying them. If you want a community, you have to make a safe space for those things to be said. Okay? In our group, there are lots of differences. Lots of different people from all kinds of walks of life. Now, we all have a common story. Again, groups have boundaries. Our common story is that we all deconstructed the same religious system. And there still are rules, like if someone comes into the group and they're unhealthy or they're looking, their motives aren't real and they're looking to manipulate or to abuse or to take advantage of someone in the group, like, sorry, I don't have time for that. But I don't care what color skin you have. And I don't care whether you're 10 years older or 10 years younger than me. And I don't care if you like to play board games and I'd rather go out and play kickball. Like, if you're a good human being and you just want to be seen and you just want to see others, then, like, amen, let's do that. What you find when you establish that space is that as people come in and go, like, oh, I get to be myself, and these people want to see the worst parts of me and they don't turn around and run away, is that suddenly people begin to trust each other in a new way. People begin to sense within each other, like, oh, this is like the healthiest, most wholesome, coolest thing I've ever been a part of. And when people start to reveal themselves in that way and feel safe, suddenly what you end up with, and this is to me the most beautiful thing, what our group does now, sometimes we'll sit around a fire and we're laughing and we're joking, but people are holding hands with arms around each other. People are sharing their sacred stories without any judgment. People are listening and people are talking knowing that they're being listened to. And suddenly the level of connection that people have, it's like we went back 2 million years ago with 15 people sitting around a campfire, and all they know to do is to know each other and to love each other and to care about each other. So you can't wait. You can't wait for people to make the community for you. You have to step out front and you have to be what you want that community to look like. Thank you. Questions on anything? Trace.
Trying to go through, by the way, first of all, thank you, Bill. I appreciate everything you share and trying to help us to progress and change and be a wider net. How do you... I'm very good at being able to allow people their weaknesses now. I'm getting better. I'm not perfect. I'm getting better. It's a lot easier for somebody who has the same amount of influence that I have. When I'm trying to give leeway to someone who can say things that can impact millions of people, sometimes negatively, sometimes to a point of suicide, it's a lot harder to give that leeway. Any pointers in trying to enable that? And then my goal is then to, as I'm trying to do that, to try to cast a net as wide as I can to protect those who are being negatively impacted by that.
Yes.
And you can assume where I'm going with.
Absolutely.
You know, it starts with an O and ends with an S. And yeah.
Okay. I'm a justice warrior. So if I see the small guy getting beat up by the big guy, I roll my sleeves up and I get in the fight. So we all have different personality types. If any of you are aware of the Enneagram, There's 9 different personality types, right? And I'm an 8. 8s love to be an 8. All the other people are like, oh, I don't like my 9. I don't like my 6. I don't like my 4. 8s love being an 8. 8s are justice warriors. I like to fight. And so my answer trace is unique to me because my personality type is unique to me. What I would suggest is that you have a right to establish healthy boundaries. You have a right to go to somebody who imposes trauma or whose motives are not healthy or who causes damage in every wake of every path they walk. And you have power to go like, I'm not putting myself in your space. You get to be you, but you're not going to do it here. We all have a right to do that. On the other hand, on some level, and we all do it in our own way, on some level we're all obligated to reduce suffering in the world and to reduce trauma. And so whatever way we can, when we see people who are fragile or vulnerable or being bullied, whatever those words are that mean those kinds of things, we are responsible to step forward in some way and do what we can to reduce suffering in the world and in that very moment with what's happening right there. I was 16 years old, and there was a 20-something-year-old cook in a restaurant that I worked at, and there was a 14-year-old. You could be 14, work in Ohio. He was 14 years old. And he was a new employee with the restaurant that I worked with, and he was a dishwasher. And suddenly this 20-something-year-old was, like, picking on him, like, bullying him. And I walked back into the kitchen, and I just caught it starting. And I just walked up to this adult, and I said, like, no, and put the kid behind me. Like, no, we're not doing this today. In your own way, do what you can to stop suffering. Do what you can to be an advocate for people who are vulnerable or easily marginalized to not be. So boundaries and find ways to make safe spaces for those who are simply trying to be themselves and make their way in the world to feel loved and accepted and protected. The kid, now the cook didn't know this, but the kid's dad was on the state highway patrol. And so immediately, none of the other people in the kitchen were doing anything. I don't understand this. And so as I get into this guy and just kind of push his chest and the kid's behind me, the kid's feelings are hurt. He goes off. And the owner of the company finally comes back and says, like, you need to know this. That guy is like his dad's a state highway patrol. You make one more move, the chances are that guy's going to show up on your doorstep and it's going to be a problem. And that guy all of a sudden was like, oh, this other guy's bigger than me, right? Bullies don't handle well when the bigger guy than them comes in the room. And that was the situation in this story. Anyway, yeah, thank you.
Bill, first of all, thanks for all that you do and for your passion and all the good that you've done. My question relates to this concept of reverse judgment. And what I mean by that is, I grew up TBM, 110%er, BYU, Ricks College, all of that. My entire network was faithful, believing members of the church, really my entire network. I hardly knew anyone outside. Going to graduate school, my circle expanded, and I'd already been going through a faith crisis when I arrived. But to get to the point, my question is, or what I'm struggling with and interested in your thoughts on are, as I backed away from full activity in the church, I really did lose my tribe, all of them. And it was easy for me to accept people that had never been in the faith and everything that came with that. But it's really has been hard and is still difficult for me to not reverse judge my former tribe and all of those people. And I consider myself somewhat awakened. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know how to engage with those people in a positive way. I live in Alpine, Utah. It's not exactly the bastion of liberal thinking or nonconformity. So that's a challenge. I'm just really interested in your thoughts.
Okay, so so do you see me doing a good job of that you're asking? Because I don't see me doing a good job of that.
I don't know you well enough to answer that question, but I see you as fair-minded and loving of other people, and so
No, I appreciate it. I'm guilty of the same problem. I look back at my tribe and I assume close-mindedness collectively, and so my default position when meeting someone individually is to assume close-mindedness. And I think the secret, and I'm not doing it that well, and again, my community has boundaries. I highly doubt an Orthodox Mormon is going to get into our club. And that's not an offense. Like, it just is natural. It just doesn't work that way. So in trying to be open to people, I think you give people the space to establish who they are. And again, just as mentioned earlier, to a lesser degree, you have a right to set healthy boundaries for the places you want to spend your time and energy. And so if somebody is close-minded and in their conversations they're always trying to sway you to be like them, then it probably isn't going to work. At the same time, if you judge because they belong to a certain system, or, you know, I don't like members of Kiwanis, so if I meet a Kiwanis, you know, now I'm going to start judging. If you make a space where you're like, I just want to see what this human is like, I just want to get to know this person and see where they're at. Now, in moving away from Mormonism, there are believing Mormons who I am perfectly at home feeling safe having a conversation of vulnerability. And there are a lot that I wouldn't. And so I think you're always testing waters. I'll give a little story, anecdotal. And this has to do with faith crises and all that stuff. A brother comes to see me at my work. Not my brother, but a guy comes to see me and he has a brother. And the guy comes to see me and he's eating lunch with me. He comes into the little office and we're just talking stories. And I said, tell me your story. Tell me what happened. Why did it fall apart? And he goes through a story and he gets to this one part where he says, like, me and my brother were 2 years apart. We both been deconstructing Mormonism for 6 years. Neither one of us believed it. And neither one of us felt safe telling the other person. And so one day, I look at my brother and I'm like, you ever heard of polyandry? And he's like, oh, yeah, right? And so suddenly this conversation ensues where they both go like, why didn't we talk to each other 6 years ago? We could have been a support while we were feeling alone. And this system, and to a greater, more collective degree, humanity, because we've moved away from intimate connection in small groups to myth being the binding force, it is the mechanism to teach us to shield, right? It's the moment our vocal cords develop the ability to gossip about each other that we also develop an ego that protects us and shields us and doesn't let anybody else see our dark places. Right? Like, oh, I have to be seen this way. Oh, I can't tell my most embarrassing story. They won't want to hang out with me. And so we have to get back to being vulnerable. And so if you sit in a space with another human being and you say, like, I'm going to just really try not to have judgment. And I'm going to, like, let this just play out. And I'm going to try, like, okay, let me be a little vulnerable. Let's see if they do it back. Let me be a little vulnerable more. Let's see if they do it back. And suddenly, if it's the right fit, within a very short time, you can sit next to that person like they're your best friend. Some of my friends became the best of friends within a day or two because it was really quick in that process of being vulnerable and authentic and then matching it and then going one layer deeper, and I would match it and go one layer deeper. You're looking for those people. That's the community you want to build. And another little trick is you have to make space for mistakes. So what happens in our group sometimes is people still gossip. What happens in our group sometimes is people end up having a fight with their significant other or say something they shouldn't have, and it blows up. And you could be like, I don't want to be around that drama. And the reality is if you want them to be as human as they possibly can, you're going to have to make space for it to be a shit show sometimes. And so you test those waters, you make space for mistakes, and you just If you do it, it just works. It just works. And if you put yourself out there, there's going to be people that will burn you. There's going to be people that will not be a right fit. But within the course of 6 months, you'll have a group of 10 people and you just love each other. And it's the realest thing you've ever had. You're welcome.
Hey,
Anthony,
Bill.
How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
We were talking about you earlier before you walked in.
In a good way.
Yeah, it was good.
Behind my back, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you already talked about this a little bit, but I think that it's applicable to the conversation. And it leads to kind of the kinds of things that Eckhart Tolle talks about. That as human beings, at least first half of life or ego or whatever, we tend to conflate our identity with our roles or forms or our experiences. We say we're an American, yeah, or I'm a Mormon or whatever, and we equate our identity to forms and constructs, and that's why deconstruction is so painful, because it's also a deconstruction of our own identity. Mm-hmm. And a change in paradigm to look at our experiences as experiences, and that our identity is our being separate from that. So that when a member in the group makes a huge mistake because they were testing boundaries or they were in pain, it doesn't affect the value of their being. It just affects their experience. And it also allows us to get curious about experiences that are good or bad or messy, or it doesn't matter, because the value of that person's being is not directly related to their experience. It's infinite, regardless of those experiences. So maybe talk about that, whether it's Eckhart Tolle or Buddhism or whatever, as to how that affects group dynamics when people feel totally accepted and validated, and that their worth and their identity is based on their being, not based on their role or reputation or their story even. It's just their experience.
Yeah. So author of The Four Agreements, is it Michael Ruiz? Miguel Ruiz? Michael Ruiz.
Miguel.
Read that book, loved it. What I loved even better was The Fifth Agreement. And if you've read The Fifth Agreement, it is right in line with this. Eckhart Tolle, A New Earth, is right in line with this. Eastern thought is always focusing on these ideas. If we're going to talk about like labels, so when our group originally meets somebody, when we're like, okay, here we are, this is our number, let's reach out and have someone else participate and let's feel out this relationship. The first time you're eating dinner with them, you're getting their story, but it's a story, right? It's a narrative. It's about my past experience, and we do that as humans. We want stories. I think it's a healthy thing to want to know someone's experiences and their story. What I find, though, happens really quickly, Anthony, is that eventually what happens is we're sitting around a fire a month later, and the stories don't matter anymore. All I care about is that these are good human beings who want to be seen and want to see. You know, when I remember being in college and they were talking about, like, what are you? What are you? If I cut off your arm, were you your arm? No, you're still you. If I poke out your eyes and make you blind, was your eyes you? No. Like, you is this consciousness in this present moment, right? And so as you feel out these communities, you're going to collect stories. Like there are certain stories that, again, you may go like, ah, is this a fit? Is it not a fit? Sure. But on some level, when you start to find good humans, the stories just fall away. Like, again, we sit around. Say there are 14 of us. We sit around a campfire and we're sitting talking. And we're joking about life and experiences, but it's not about the labels anymore. It doesn't matter who's male or female. It doesn't matter who's interested in this book and who's listening to that podcast. It doesn't matter what country this person's from or what language they can speak. It doesn't matter. Reza Aslan was here Thursday night, right? And I didn't get a chance to meet him. We didn't get here till Friday. But I wanted to meet the guy. Like, I think highly of his intellect and the way in which he shaped ideas. He's not Mormon. I read him 7 years ago, Zealot. And at the time, it was this, like, confrontation of, like, I'm Mormon and his ideas are bad. And as time went on, I just grew this admiration for, like, wow, he has different ideas than me. And he studies things out and he thinks about things and he's presenting concepts that I'd never thought of before. You get to a place where the people you associate with, you want to learn so bad that diversity becomes a cool tool. It becomes a cool resource. I'm not judging their experience like, do they fit in or don't they? I'm judging their experience like they have something new to offer this eclectic group and to give us something new and to go like, oh, we can all learn from this. And so labels are important and they're worthless. And I think you have to sit with both of those ideas at the same time.
I'm a pretty radical relativist. And so my question for you is, if you went back, so when I say I'm a radical relativist, I mean that I am not at all convinced that being on a post-Mormon side is any better than being on the Mormon side. So my question for you is, if you went back to your experiences when you first joined Mormonism and thought about the kinds of things that you said about meeting other Mormons and having this immediate connection with them, is it any different? Because it feels to me like when you talk about vulnerability and authenticity, that when I was in my Mormon phase, I would have said that was all of my connections with other Mormons were based on authenticity and vulnerability. So does this just happen to us over and over again? Are we going to fall, we post-Mormons, are we going to fall out of these relationships again? Is it just part of the process of being human? It has nothing to do with Mormonism or fake Mormonism or feeling like people are inauthentic within Mormonism. It's just that we change and we have to find some new authenticity.
Okay, I love it. So two thoughts come to mind. One is that there are moments where I'm like, oh, everything is so perfect right now. I'm going to hold on to this. And let's be honest, 5 seconds later, it's already changed. It's already moved. It's already something different. And so one is a recognition that living present is all you ever have. And if you're planning on the past or the future, we pulled out of a restaurant just a few minutes ago before we came to this session after eating lunch. And I'm getting ready to turn into a lane that I have to turn in. And my wife sees that I have to cross 4 lanes of traffic. And she's like, you can see, like, oh, I don't know how you're going to do this. And I get up to where I got to turn, and there's just no traffic. Like, we didn't need to worry about it. It took care of itself. And so part of it is realizing that being present is the past and the future don't matter, because the only moment you got is right now. And right now. And right now. My wife and I, if I can be a little obscene, my wife and I are laying in bed nude, just loving each other a couple of weeks ago. And all of a sudden, she's in her head, and she's going like, oh, I got to make sure I do this tomorrow. Oh, I got to make sure I think about it. I'm like, baby, I'm right here, right now, right now. I think if you can figure out ways to enjoy the present, I'm simply saying like, yeah, at that moment, it was awesome. And at this moment, it feels better. But I don't know that it really is or isn't, but I know it sure feels like it, and I'm going to enjoy this moment right now. The other thing I would say is that there is a reality to how much we fit in and how much we're able to be ourselves and belong. And it may have felt real then, and I may have just had all the same feelings of joy and happiness, and if we're going to measure that, maybe they're equal. But there's also a recognition in this moment, I can be more of myself, and something deep inside me tells me that's better. And I don't even know if I can measure it.
I have to organize my thoughts, so.
Go for it.
I just wanted to say thank you, because I haven't really connected a whole lot with many of these speakers, because I haven't labeled anything. I don't label. So honest to goodness, I hate podcasts to the nth degree, and my husband loves them. So
I do like 5 of them, just so you know.
Yeah. I know. And I know this because my husband's like, oh, we have to go to this. I was like, oh my gosh, it's a podcaster. But
I've got a face made for radio too, so.
So he had showed this to me. before, and I saw the name, I was like, I'm not going to that, because he's a podcaster. So then he shows me, just earlier when we were at the last one, he shows me this abstract, and I read it, and I go, oh, yeah, that's really great. And I was like, you dirty, rotten dog, you tricked me, because you didn't show me what it was. You just showed me the abstract. So anyway, I just wanted to say thank you, because I really, really, truly enjoyed this, and I may actually listen to your podcast now. But... But that being said, I felt very connected throughout this whole thing, because I too am like that social fighter, to the point where like I literally caused myself in a position where I had to resign because I was fighting against my principal because he was so horrible to those underdog kids who were labeled the bad kids. And then here they are, sixth grade labeled the bad kids, to eighth grade where I have them. And he was going to kick this kid out of school. And I was like, that wasn't even that kid. You have no idea. And I stood up to him, and he literally pushed me back into a pillar. And I was like, I don't want to be here anymore. So I quit my job, and I went home to my husband. I was like, oh my gosh, I just quit my job. I resigned at the end of the year. What am I going to do? And he was just like, I don't know. So anyway, I went and found another job. So we're good there. But I found that the past few years of teaching, like, I felt, I don't know, just that I give and give and give and give. And it's always to uplift others and to make people feel safe and comfortable and happy. And that's just what I want. That's what I want for everyone, right? And then I got to a point in myself, sorry. Oh, don't you hate the criers at church? Dang it, I'm one of them. But I got to a point where I literally gave so much of myself that my health, like I went paralyzed on half my body. And I had some really big health issues that almost cost me my life. And at that point, Western medicine had failed me. And so my husband, who enjoys Colorado, let's just say that. He enjoys Colorado a lot. And I was like so against this. But one day I just said, I've had a migraine for a year without it ceasing. And so he was like, just try this. And so I'm not like, oh yes, I'm totally like, you know, but the whole paradigm shift came to me that saying, you know what, it's not, there's all this gray area. Sorry, I keep getting off.
Oh, you're good.
Initial question. I am a backstory person, but so I just, how do you combat that you give until there's nothing left of you? And how do you combat that? And how have you built up like maybe the processes that you need to combat like giving everything to where it literally drives you crazy or your health is conflicted? How do you help so many people and still have enough of yourself to function?
Yeah. So first, to speak to your experience with the job resigning, if you're not in the arena getting your ass kicked, I don't care about your opinion. Thank you for putting yourself in the arena and getting your ass kicked, but in a way that you came out on top, standing up for what you believed in. So thank you. Self-care. So as a justice warrior, I go. How many posts a day do I put out on Facebook, Anthony? How many times am I poking people and poking bears and smacking tigers in the face?
I think you asked me to monitor 7 days a day, something like that.
Yeah, so I asked Anthony. I said a year ago I talked to Anthony. I said, Anthony, I'll give you my Facebook user login and password. You pretend you're me, and you put out compassionate posts. And I'll just stand back and like I'll just rest for a while. But I wouldn't let you do that, would I?
No,
I wouldn't. So I'm constantly fighting. And as you relate to that, yes, there are times where like I'm worn out. That's it. And so luckily the weekend comes every, 5 days of work, and then here's the weekend, and now my friends want to hang out, and now I'm sitting around a fire and I'm enjoying a cold beverage. I'm having a time where I am letting go of everything, and I'm just being present with these people who love me and I love them. And then by Monday, I'm ready to go back to fight again. And for all of us, those timetables will look different, even different for us individually at different times of our life. And self-care is knowing, like, I want to fight and I want to protect all these people, but I can't. And so sometimes I got to step back and I just got to, like, shut down to all of this so that I can take care of me. And so when you, the moment you sense, like, okay, I'm getting into that space, and now I'm 40 years old, I know pretty quickly when I'm like, okay, I got to take a breather. And then I just go do some self-care. I spend time with my wife. I go spend time with my friends. I don't talk about some of the issues that enrage me. And I just reground and recenter and then go back to it on Monday.
He gave me permission to make a comment. So we created a local Mormon spectrum group, a support group in Billings, Montana. We have about 50 members. But when we do meetups, generally about 12 to 15 people show up. And it's similar to what you're talking about. And I think that I have permission to share this, but there's one member of our group who's a therapist, and she's a social justice warrior. And she said the value of the group is when I show up, I'm not showing up as a therapist. I'm showing up as myself. And so part of the weekend is you need a place where you can show up as yourself, not as the warrior.
Not your labels.
Not as your label, not as a warrior, not in your role, but to just be.
Yeah, we're to the point where when I sit around that fire with those friends, nobody's going like, Bill, I really love listening to you. Like, you're such a, that was a great podcast you put out. No, like it's just 14 humans just being with each other and just not needing any of those labels to matter. Anyway, Adam, did you have something?
Yeah. What's up, man? So I see this like polarization right now in America, and it's like it's in politics, it's religion, it's everything. It's not exclusive to Mormonism, but I kind of wanted to, since we're at Sunstone, kind of keep it within a construct of Mormonism. Like, I find myself still kind of in that middle way. And I think you were that way for many years, right?
Yeah.
I saw the evolution of your podcast
yeah.
between the early days, even when you're popping in on like New Order Mormon and kind
yeah.
of busting it there all the way to where your trajectory has been now, right? But I've been wondering why I find myself like more comfortable in the middle and in the cafeteria style. And part of it is probably my personality. Part of it is probably my reliance on social needs, like my community. You know, I live in Davis County, and it's pretty heavily full of active Mormons, and a lot of my family is Mormon, and so I feel more comfortable there, I think, just kind of doing it my own way. But as I see, like, between apologists and critics and everyone else in between, and it's like, logically, I probably see myself aligning more with the critical arguments, but, like, I don't really care where anyone falls within Mormonism, from the strongest of apologists to the fiercest of critics. I don't really care. I just want people to, like, be okay with one another, right? And I see, like, social media as such a big player in what it's doing to this polarization, and I'm wondering, like, how do we bridge that gap? Like, what do we do to, like, to get both sides of the aisle to kind of more meet in the middle and find a common ground where we're just more okay with each other despite our beliefs and where we fall on it.
Okay, so again, I think I suck at that. So, but I'll share two ideas. One is directly related to Mormonism. About a year ago, I had this thought, and our group talks about this sometimes. I'll be dead, and Mormonism will still be alive. Like, if my goal is to just burn the mother down, right, I'm going to lose. I lose. I'll be dead. It's still going to be alive. So I got to a point where I decided, like, yes, I'm still justice warrioring, right? But I also decided, like, I'm not really going to fix it. Like, I used to think I'm going to fix it. Me and these other 47 voices that are out there that are these people really pushing, we're going to fix it. And I give up on that. It's going to move and change and shift, but when I'm 6 feet in the ground, there's still going to be problems and unhealthiness and trauma. That's one. So I just, coming to grips, like, all you're doing is expending energy when that energy can be used elsewhere, the emotional energy can be used elsewhere. And I think once we take that view, something just softens a little bit in us. And I'm not there yet, but I'm softer. And I know it doesn't seem like it on Facebook, but I really am softer now than I was 2 years ago. So that's one. There was another one. Give me a second. I used to be huge. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh. I helped out with the George Bush campaign. Worked for the Republican group there in my hometown and put yard signs out and, you know, got up at 4 a.m. to make sure there were signs everywhere for voting and just really thinking about those things. And I don't at all. This is part of that emotional energy. There's still going to be division when I'm dead. There's still going to be problems in this country when I'm dead. And so as I was so concerned, every Friday I would go to my grandfather's house and in the backyard were lawn chairs sitting around, and all of us, my dad's one of 8 children, all 8 kids, and as many of the grandkids as who could get off work and show up, showed up, right? We sat in the backyard, and we fought with each other over whether deficits were important or where spending should be and which sports team was going to win. And then probably 3 or 4 years ago, I just stopped caring. Not caring like, let's make the world a better place. I don't care about that. I stopped caring about all of the stuff that's outside of my realm of influence. So I stopped listening to political talk shows. I stopped watching the news. Like, I'll check the Drudge Report once every 2 weeks. That's my news, just to catch major issues. I stopped caring about the places I really couldn't have any change or difference in the world. And the moment you do that, like, all that really matters now are the people right in front of you. You're not really worried about this over there that you can't affect. Now, I'm still concerned about big things when they happen. When I see all of this stuff with people crossing the border illegally, and then what's happening to them, and going on with their children and them, and these cages and all that nonsense, like, there's a part of me that's hurt that we can't figure out better ways to do this human thing. But also, like, there's only so much I can do and only so much you guys can do. And if you're expending so much energy and anger and frustration and this side needs to win and that side's going to lose. And at some point, man, I want to spend my energy with people around me and make their life better. I'd much rather go to my friend's house and help them put gravel in their driveway and impact somebody directly that I can, then sit in some space and just scream and yell and get hurt inside. So part of it was me just letting go. And maybe it sounds careless, like, Bill, there's real problems, go fix them. No, Mormonism is the one I can't let go of. Sorry, Anthony. But everywhere else, like, I don't care. I just don't care. And that allows me to put my energy in this place of, like, let me help people who want to be helped and are within my realm of influence. That made it much easier.
Let's see, how far down will this go? First, I just wanted to say something to you about what you were talking about. I've kind of, I guess, had a faith crisis for 30 years, which is a long time, and most people resolve a lot better, faster than I did, I guess. But, I still go to church because of my youngest child. Out of 5 kids, I still have 1 child that still lives with me. He's handicapped, and he's all in still. So I still do that for him. But and it was his birth with his terrible disability that caused my faith crisis. I knew all of a sudden it was, you know, a can of worms, and it just didn't fit. It all didn't work anymore. And so that was very personal to me. It wasn't just intellectual. It was my life. Yeah. It was the most important thing in my life that had just fallen apart for me, and the fear of what would happen to him. And so, you know, through all those years, but I had a whole bunch of kids, you know, had a husband, and through all those years of trying to figure out, it only took me a few months after his birth to know that I didn't believe any of it anymore. And but I still loved the part of me that was the good part because of Mormonism. So it's just not cut and dried. And so for a long, long time, I was just kind of in this other place. And I noticed through all those years and still notice the people that are like you were talking about, that are still the TBMs or whatever, they're only doing that because it makes them feel safe. They are holding on to all of that because it makes them feel safe. And they're not doing it to be jerks. Some of them may be. But most of them, I really don't believe, are doing that to be jerks. They're doing it because they desperately need that. And so if I would try to reach out to people and say, well, personal prayer and revelation didn't work for me for this, for this especially, they didn't want to listen to me, they didn't want to understand, because they still felt safe. They still felt safe if they would just follow and keep being a TBM. They were still safe. Their kids weren't going to get handicapped. Their husband wasn't going to die at a young age. That hadn't happened to them. It only happened to me because I wasn't faithful enough. And they just needed that safety. And I still see that so much that, you know, it's a mechanism for feeling safe. And we're taught that so much. You'll be safe if you follow this, if you think what we want you to think, if you you'll be more safe. So that kind of helps me cut them a lot of slack and still love them as a friend or a person, because I know that's just where they are. And I also wanted to ask you, can you give us a few little nuts and bolts on how to create this community, like so that we're not just out trying to reinvent the wheel? That, like, just give us a few nuts and bolts. Just how do you go about trying to create that community for yourself that you said we have to create? We have to do it.
Yeah, so, again, I don't think there's a formula that you can spell out. We moved to Southern Utah because a husband and a wife that were listeners to the podcast first took a chance on being vulnerable with us, and we reciprocated that vulnerability. So now there were four of us, and they offered our family, me, a job with the company that they owned, and for our family to move to Southern Utah. Now there were four of us. The next thing that happened was we met a lesbian couple that we made a safe space for them to be them, and we reciprocated that. And now there were six of us. And then as we keep our ears to the ground, like I want to be around human beings, and I want to be around good humans. And so as you begin to reach out and say, like, oh, I see those two people over there. They seem interesting. They seem good. Let's invite them to dinner. And now there's eight of us. And in the process of doing that, of 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, you also have to have a sense of like a trial period. And some people, not even because like, oh, good humans are in and bad humans are out, but even good humans don't fit the boundaries of this group. When people do human, when they live out their lives as a human being, that expresses itself in a multitude of ways. Some people are going to participate in activities that aren't interesting to me and even feel threatening to me. Some people are going to participate in activities that are too conservative for me. And so as we're allowing this group to meet new people and to enjoy this space with people and see who's good and who isn't, who fits and who doesn't, you're also going to come into where people aren't a good fit. And it's not a matter of like wanting to hurt someone's feelings. It's just, it's not a good fit. And so you have to allow yourself to say like, okay, this is the kind of community we're trying to build. We can't get away from it having some level of boundaries and lines, and this just isn't a good fit. And the other thing you have to recognize is that when we first started this process, we thought, okay, now there's six of us. Now there's eight of us. What if we could get to 150 of us? And you have to let that idea go. Because the moment you get to somewhere between 15 and 25, gossip now becomes the mechanism. And so you have to settle with the recognition that the group is, if you want it to be this kind of community, it has to be small. And so maybe you only find three people, and maybe you only find five, but you're not going to find 50. Because if you have a group of 50, it's not the community I'm talking about.
What did you do for your kids?
All of our families, this is, and maybe we're not doing really good at this one, right? All of our families have, for the most part, teenagers or really young adults, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. And there's one or two families that have a little bit younger kids, but not like babies, but a little younger. So the other thing you have to recognize is that the age of people and the age of their children is going to be a deep factor in this group. And sometimes we get hurt, like, dang it, I'm 10 years younger than them. Why won't they hang around me? Or they're 10 years older. And on some level, like, the age of kids and ages, those do play a part. We spend time with our friends, just us adults hanging out most of the time. And then maybe once a month or so, one of us will have a cookout or a get together, and we'll all get together. And in the course of that, then these kids kind of pick out who they're getting along with and who they're not. And the kids start asking, like, hey, can I go to so-and-so's house and play with so-and-so? You know, so some of that naturally happens. But we're not intentionally, our kids, all of our kids are collectively, for the most part, able to kind of manage themselves while we go out for a few hours. And so we're not intentionally working to force the kids into the same community structure. This is only adults I'm talking about. And so again, it's just not a perfect thing. It's messy. Yeah, love it. Good point. So what Anthony's asking is, what is the social mechanism for keeping everybody in contact with each other? Are we almost out of time? 5 minutes. Okay, the social mechanism for our group is a text message thread. Every day, out of this group of people, one of us at least is texting the other, telling a joke, and we're all in the group. It's not like these are individual messages out there. This is a group of 14 or 16 people. And every day somebody's putting a meme, or somebody's talking about a podcast they listen to, somebody's talking about a book they read. There's continual sharing of life and reciprocating of validation of experiences. And that is happening on a daily basis. And then again, somebody in that group is always saying, like, oh, it's Wednesday. Nobody's messaged yet about a get together. Party's at my house, 7 o'clock on Saturday. What, you know, everybody brings something. Bring an adult beverage, bring something to snack on, whatever it is. And it's different things. Some people want to go do a group hike. Some people want to play Jackbox on the TV. Some people want to play a board game. Some people just want to drink and tell stories. So we mix up the kinds of events we're doing, but we're in constant contact on a daily basis. And let me say another thing about connection. All of us go, like, I wonder if this is real. I wonder if I really fit in. Those people are really cool. I don't really feel that cool. I'm not sure they're really accepting me. All of that is a story you're telling yourself. When you find these kinds of people, that story just gets to fall by the wayside. And it's just good humans just fully accepting each other as good humans. You need that. You need a mechanism to create a regular, consistent interaction to keep that cohesiveness. Just like the great apes are going out every day and grooming each other, us humans need these interactions to keep these relationships, that kind of connection going. Uh-oh, here we go.
No, I just wanted to speak to you because instead of Utah, somebody also had made a Facebook page for the Southern ex-Mormon kind of progressive Mormon whatever. And so the people with the younger children, I know someone had reached out and was like, okay, we're going to have a park play date on Sunday at this park, and like we'll pin which park they're going to. You know, so like you said, the age of your kids kind of does matter. And so, you know, make a Facebook group if you don't have one in your area or something, and put out, hey, we're having this so your kids can, get together and so you are forming those bonds with your kids. Like I said, ours are a little bit older, so we're kind of past that, but I know it is important for people that do have the younger families and to get them together and things like that. So
yeah,
that's also an option.
Yeah, we were just at a party on July 4th with not our core group, but folks just kind of outside that layer that we knew, and we knew they were good people, but we just hadn't hung around them much, and they all had younger children. And they did that. They just put out a message on this collective, progressive ex-Mormon group and said, like, hey, anybody with young kids, we're having a get-together July 4th. And it was like 7, 8, 9 of them that just showed up, and they just had a great time just building bonds with each other. And now they're inviting each other to other things. Like, they built that new community. They built that friendship. Just a little plug for me. If you have, and if you don't care, it doesn't matter to me. You don't have to do this. But if you on your device, if you go to almostawakened.org, thanks, Trace. Yeah, thumbs up. It's the newest podcast that I've started. I've started with my friend Mikkel. And if you look at that, almostawakened.org, you'll see the logo. And it's a gender ambiguous head. And on the top of the head are psychedelic mushrooms. And out of the head are all these cool things like books and Eastern thought ideas and the word friends in a Chinese symbol. I think there's the Buddha sitting there. There's just tons of little things. I'm simply suggesting that when we are almost awakened, I think you said earlier, like, I'm kind of awakened. Like, we're all almost awakened. Like, there's so many cool facets and topics and ideas. And as you start to build your community, you got to have things that are the center of conversations. And as the group is invested in continued learning, all of those kinds of topics that are in the head are the kinds of things that almost awakened people are thinking about and talking about. But find your own things too. Maybe I'm missing a few of those kinds of things up in that logo. Anyway.
I'll just put that plug out as well, is that if you like today's session, that's Almost Awakened. That podcast is great for that. So you were going through and thinking, I think you would love this podcast. So just want to let you know. Even though you don't like podcasts.
You're going to come back next year and go, I love
you might
podcasters.
Be a, yeah, yeah. So.
I am against you. No, I'm not this is a the one. Either. This is my husband. I love you, babe. I don't listen to him. But I love
We just released an episode this morning. Yeah, we just released one this morning on death. Like, what does it mean if you know someone who's dying? What does it mean to, like, think about your own death? I love the depth of conversations that can be mined now versus what I experienced in my earlier life of a very limited view of a limited acceptable amount of topics that could be discussed and a certain amount of perspectives. And I don't want to do that anymore. I want to be open. I want to talk about things that I'm doing, and I want to talk about real things that we're all thinking about and wrestling with. So anyway, thank you guys very much.